Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs. And every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, EMS calls are rising in Connecticut, but Lamont wants to delay additional funds, by Jose Luis Martinez for the Connecticut Mirror. Additional funding for ambulance providers included in the biennium budget last year was scrapped in the governor's proposed budget adjustments released last month, leaving EMS professionals across the state disappointed. The state of Connecticut has not really prioritized emergency medical services. We are not an essential service in this state, said Nicholas Maltby, chief of service at New Hartford Volunteer Ambulance. Governor Ned Lamont's proposed budget said it would be premature to include the additional funding because the state is still studying Medicaid reimbursement rates. New findings are due early next year. The additional funding comes in the form of Medicaid reimbursement for ambulance providers. Medicaid is the state's public health insurance, known as HUSCE, which provides financial assistance to people below certain income thresholds. HUSCE was used as payment for EMS services at least 44,000 times each year in 2021 and 2022. That's according to the most recent annual report from the state's Office of Emergency Medical Services. In response to the lack of additional funding, ambulance providers gathered at the Capitol to urge lawmakers to restore funding. Maltby, along with other EMS workers from around the state, testified to the Appointments Committee, which needs to recommend any adjustments to the 2024-2025 budget. Lamont's proposed budget adjustments note that ambulance providers received additional funding in the last biennium, but providers say that removing next year's additional funding would be devastating to their already scarce resources. Meanwhile, state data shows that ambulance staff remain busy. EMS providers across the state responded to anywhere from 55,000 emergencies in April 2020 to as many as 83,000 in December 2022, according to data from OEMS. Data for 2023 will be released later this year in the office's annual report. About 2.5 million emergency responses were made during those 3 years. But some EMS providers' staff numbers dropped by 2022. It's almost like a perfect storm, said Maltby. 41 EMS providers saw their number of active crew members decrease from 2020 to 2022, according to data reported to OEMS, with another 59 seeing no change or an increase. Stratford EMS, Newington Volunteer Ambulance Corp., and American Ambulance Service Incorporated all lost over 70 active members. Services in Suffield, Westport, Lyme, and Wilton all saw member decreases of 20 or more, along with American Medical Response and Northern Dutchess Paramed. Ambulance providers vary in their structure, with some funded by their town, while others are nonprofit, commercial, or volunteer-based. Some providers say they're losing volunteers and resorting to hiring paid staff, which further strains their budgets. Quote, our ability to help each other has gone down, while the number of calls has gone up, said Maltby, referring to mutual aid, which occurs when an ambulance provider assists a patient outside their service area. Calls for mutual aid increased from 4,887 in 2021 to 6,515 in 2022. That's a 33% increase. Quote, let's say we're out on something small, you know, somebody's just feeling sick, and then we end up with a car versus motorcycle accident. Well, who comes to that call, said Maltby. Right now, There are so many times where basically every ambulance in our area is out on a call and there's nothing left. And so far, we have not had that nightmare call. For some rural towns, having more crew members is critical because of the longer time it takes to get to a scene and then to a hospital. Longer response times means having to rely on mutual aid or more volunteers. Among all towns in 2022, about 9 minutes was the average response time from the moment a unit is notified by dispatch of an emergency to the moment it arrives on the scene. But some towns, like Washington, had average response times as high as almost 19 minutes. Another 16 towns had average response times above 15 minutes. The lowest average wait time was experienced in New London at just over 5 minutes. That's followed by Windsor Locks and Greenwich. The next article is titled, "It's a Travesty. Hundreds in Connecticut with Intellectual Disabilities on Wait List, No Group Home Space," by Ed Stannard for the Hartford Current. Zoe Benjamin has extremely serious intellectual disabilities. Quote, "My husband and I took care of her until 3 years ago when he died," said her mother, Adrian Benjamin. "She's nonverbal. She needs help with all aspects of personal hygiene. She's very physically active. She runs around like a crazy girl, but she has no safety awareness. So she would run in the street, touch the hot stove, can't be safe alone in the bathroom, in the bathtub, or anything." Zoe Benjamin is 27. Adrian Benjamin and Zoe's father, Stephen Horowitz, took care of her until Horowitz died 3 years ago. Then Zoe Benjamin was able to get into a group home in Wethersfield, run by HARC of Hartford, one of the social service agencies that receives money from the State Department of Developmental Services. Quote, "We were suddenly designated to be an emergency after my husband died. He had cancer," said Adrian Benjamin, who lives in New Britain. "And so she got an emergency group home placement. The Benjamins were fortunate. The wait list for placement in group homes stood at 710 at the end of fiscal 2023, according to Governor Ned Lamont's office. That number is a significant reduction from the 934 the previous year. The number of families waiting for placements had been growing since 2019, when the wait list stood at 759. The most recent high was 1,015 in 2017. The CEOs of HARC and other agencies say a major problem in getting more people like Zoe Benjamin into group homes is the low pay for their staff, which stands at $17.25 an hour. Quote, "I have four group homes that today are sitting vacant," said Barry Simon, CEO of Oak Hill in Hartford, who has led such agencies for 32 years. "I could be creating jobs and take people off the wait list if the state wanted to pay reasonable wages, but they don't," he said. "To find employees for $17 an hour who are wanting and willing to do personal hygiene for people, change adult diapers, give people showers and bathing, and do the food prep and understand the medical needs and the medications that are needed. These are tough jobs. They're skilled jobs, and people have to be dedicated to doing that." A very sad waiting list. Zoe Benjamin was evaluated as a 7 on the 8-point level of need scale used by DDS to determine where someone falls on 3 wait lists: emergency, urgent, and planning. Adrian Benjamin said there are more than 100 people on the emergency list. Quote, "The law mandates school for people with disabilities till they're 21, she said. "But there's no mandate after someone turns 21 for any services at all. So that's why there's a huge waiting list, a very sad waiting list for people. I mean, if my husband hadn't died, we'd still be waiting, even though I'm 71. So once you're in a true emergency situation, like a desperate emergency situation. Then you can get services. Tamara and Andrew Sellinger have two children with Fragile X syndrome and autism, Brian, 30, and Jody, 33. Brian is in a group home run by the Jewish Association for Community Living of Bloomfield, but Jody is not. And Andrew Sellinger is no longer able to provide as much care since he had a heart attack 3 years ago. Both of the Sellinger's children also are listed as 7 of 8 on the level of need scale. Quote, "The care needed for our daughter is supervision 100% for safety," Andrew Sellinger said. "She does not have safety awareness in the case that if there was an emergency, a fire, she would not know how to respond. She would freeze. Then she would not be able to communicate well. She needs help with basically all of her daily living activities. After I had a heart attack and realized that I have some issues, we asked to be put on the urgent list," he said. "That's been 3 years since then. So it's very concerning that there's a moratorium on group homes when the need exists. The other issue, it's not just the residential placement. It's basically the funding for the providers, for the people, for our lifeline. We're dealing with human lives. We're dealing with people that will have trauma as a result of these decisions. And that's what it's all about to families." While the personal care aides in group homes make $17.25 an hour, compared with the state's $15.69 minimum wage, and Lamont's fiscal 2025 budget keeps their pay at that level, the governor recently negotiated a contract with the state's largest health care union that will bring home health care aides' pay to $23 an hour in fiscal 2026. The contract with New England Healthcare Employees Union, SEIU 1199NE, brings a 26% increase over 3 years, as well as longevity bonuses, expanded pay time off, and reduced health insurance costs. Quote, "They are independent contractors doing the same work in people's homes," said Simon. "They take care of people with intellectual developmental disabilities. They take care of people who are aging. They take care of people who are medically fragile, but they do it as independent contractors." Adrian Benjamin said the aides in the group homes should be paid equally to the home health aides, but the governor's frequently cited fiscal guardrails, mostly spending and borrowing caps, are hurting those in need of services. Quote, "I consider the staff who take care of my daughter as human guardrails," she said. "They're the ones that keep her from touching something hot on the stove. They're the ones that keep her from walking outside and into the street. So the state depends on these human guardrails to take care of people with disabilities and the homeless. There's a lot of unmet needs." In an email, Lamont spokesman Chris Colaby said, "Governor Lamont and the Department of Developmental Services, DDS, acknowledge that workforce limitations and real estate constraints within our provider community have indeed posed significant hurdles, slowing our efforts to match individuals with their appropriate and preferred residential settings at the rate supported in the enacted budget. However, it's important to note that Governor Lamont and his administration are fully committed to improving the lives of the residents of our state and reducing the DDS residential wait list through various initiatives. These measures, though faced with obstacles, have begun to yield positive results, showing a promising trend in wait list management. The administration's vision is to see all Connecticut residents we support as valued contributors to their communities, being able to utilize their personal strengths, talents, and passions. Any increase in funding must fit in a balanced budget that adheres to all statutory and constitutional caps. Colaby also pointed out initiatives for placements with caregivers over 65, those requesting community companion homes, supportive housing, and others, as well as an $85 million increase in wages for personal care assistants in fiscal 2023. Jordan Scheff, Commissioner of the Department of Developmental Services, who administers a $1.5 billion budget that serves 17,000 people, said, "There are certainly some areas where we struggle and have struggled, and one of those areas has been historically the wait list. Although we have made some inroads there in the past couple of years and are happy about that, certainly it's not at the brisk pace families waiting for supports would like, and I certainly understand that." He said supportive housing and other ways to integrate people into the community have helped those who are able to live more independently, if not families like the Sellingers and the Benjamins. But creating new group homes is a slow, expensive process, said Scheff. "When the legislature generously supported House Bill 501 last year, I said to them that they could dump buckets of money at my feet, and it wouldn't allow me to just immediately eliminate the wait list," he said. "Eliminating the wait list is a multi-year process, in part because even if we just assume there was this bucket of money to do so, we need the staff to provide the supports. We need the buildings to provide the facilities, the actual physical space for people to live. And right now, we're in the midst of a nationwide workforce crisis in multiple sectors, but certainly impacting the intellectual developmental disability community." Building new group homes requires following local and state regulations, zoning issues, taking out loans, and other issues, said Scheff. "My agency and my staff, from top to bottom, work every day to try and improve the lives of people in this state with intellectual disability," he said. "And they do so tirelessly, and through the pandemic, and now through this, the unwinding side. I'm thrilled with the work that they do. I know that it's not always meeting the expectations of everyone involved, but we are invested in trying to improve the situation for everybody currently receiving services." Equity and inclusion. Barry Simon at Oak Hill hears the family's expectations daily, and he questions the priorities of the governor and the General Assembly, which will be taking up Lamont's midterm budget this session. Quote, "It is really hard to have parents who desperately want services to not be able to access them. And this is absolutely an access issue when it comes to our policymakers prioritizing our services and the kinds of services we provide," he said. "Having been at this for 32 years, there's always some sort of reason why we're not a priority for sustained rates that allow us and our employees, both for the services that we do and for the jobs that they have, to be part of success in our economy." He said politicians talk about equity and inclusion for people, and the people we serve have been fighting for years for equity and inclusion when it comes to embracing and enjoying all that society has to offer. And yet the institutional discrimination that just continues to be perpetuated is something that they don't hold themselves to or be accountable for. He said agencies haven't had rate increases for room and board for 10 years, in addition to the lack of pay increases for the personal care assistants. "I can't tell you how many elderly parents who still have kids living at home because they love their kids and they have wanted to be there, but are now at a point where they can no longer lift them in or out of a bath or can't help them move out of a wheelchair into a bed," said Simon. "And yet we're creating wait lists for services because of the rates that are paid for those services." Staff vacancies. Russell Coleman, CEO of HARC, said the wait list could be shortened without building new homes. Raising staff pay would allow him to care for more residents. "Here at HARC 24/7 group homes, we have a 45% vacancy rate for our staff, 45%, he said. "That's really hard. It's very difficult because when you start talking about providing care, you're shortfalling people with recreation, with those fun activities, going out and doing things. And it's really focusing on more of the health and safety at that point because you have limited staff. He said he relies on people working overtime and hiring contracted staff to fill the gaps, who just don't know our individuals well because they're only in and out. So it's really difficult. Coleman said many people would rather work at a department store and make the same money with less responsibility. Our employees are just overworked. They're working 60 to 85 hours a week and have a second job on top of that just to make ends meet here in Connecticut. It's just a travesty, he said. We should do so much more by them because it's really a population that we serve, said Coleman. They are no different than anybody else. They just need extra assistance, just to have a meaningful day. And if we're not able to provide that, I mean, it's really disheartening. The next article, on a lighter note, is titled, What's in Your Shopping Cart? Notables from the world of food and nutrition share grocery items and shopping hacks that they can't live without. By Stephen Perrine. Danny Trejo, 79. Actor and restaurateur. What's in his cart? Eggs, chicken, corn, tortillas, cheese, mangoes, ice cream, and some not-too-spicy hot sauce. Danny Trejo's growing restaurant empire, he now operates a chain of 5 Trejo's Tacos, demonstrates that healthy food can be fast, easy, and most important, affordable, he says. Growing up, affording healthy food was a real issue. The first of the month meals could be pretty elaborate, but then along the 15th, that's when we'd say, hey, Mom, what's this? And she'd say, it's called Never Mind, Eat It. That free-form approach to cooking has stuck with him. Breakfast is often scrambled eggs with tortillas, always traditional corn tortillas. They're a lot healthier, he says. In fact, you can put just about anything in a tortilla. Whatever sounds good, just put it in a corn tortilla and you're set. At the local market near his home in Los Angeles, he'll always stuff his cart with fruit. Come Sunday, Trejo likes putting out a big tray with blue cheese dressing, fruits and vegetables, and it's Let's Go Rams. One thing you won't find in his shopping cart, super hot sauce. It's an aversion left over from his childhood. The men in my family would say, hey, Danny, don't eat this. It's for men. He just called you a girl. Now you gotta eat it. And it felt like your teeth would fall out. He prefers seasoning his food with pico de gallo, something that adds flavor rather than just heat. How does Trejo stay in such intimidating physical shape heading into his 9th decade? Weight training and plenty of walking. The biggest problem, he says, especially in the Latino community, is that a lot of our food is starchy. A lot of our food is fatty. So if you don't exercise, it's going to sit there and you're going to get fat. I've been the same weight, 175 pounds for years. Dean Ornish, MD, 70, lifestyle medicine specialist and best-selling author. What's in his cart? Dark chocolate, blueberries, fresh and frozen produce, soy and almond milk, tofu and tempeh, beans and lentils. Dean Ornish will always be known as the man who put the president on a diet. After years of heart issues, Bill Clinton turned to Ornish to help him drop pounds and keep his arteries clear. Ornish responded with the plant-based lifestyle program he's been prescribing for his patients for years. It's very low in fat and sugar, meaning that in addition to most animal foods, fatty fruits like olives, avocados, and coconut are also off the table, and nuts and seeds are eaten in moderation. But if he sounds like a dietary downer, Ornish begs to differ. A lot of people think, am I going to live forever or is it just going to seem longer, he says with a laugh. But he says that a low-fat, plant-based diet can provide fast results. Your brain is getting more blood, so your cognitive function improves. Your skin is getting more blood, so you look younger. Your sex organs are getting more blood in a way that works like Viagra. To amp up the joy around the Ornish house, Dean often joins his wife, Anne, in what she calls her chocolate meditations. You can spend several minutes savoring a high-quality dark chocolate and get far more from it than a cheap, sugary candy bar, says Anne. It's a false choice, choosing between what's good for you and what's fun for you. For Ornish, that means a lot of fresh fruit. Frozen fruits are less expensive, and you can eat them at any time of the year. Almond and soy milk are his go-to dietary alternatives. Tofu, tempeh, beans, and vegan yogurt and cheese are also in the mix. And finding pleasure in eating is important as well, says Ornish. Food has a way of bringing people together, and intimacy is healing. Al Roker, 69, co-host, Today. What's in his cart? Vegetables, plenty of fresh herbs, and fresh-caught fish. For more than 25 years, Al Roker has been forecasting the weather and investigating the latest trends in nutrition and weight loss for millions of Today Show viewers. But he's also known for his personal courage in documenting his own weight loss journey and health challenges, from his gastric bypass in 2002 to battles with prostate cancer, blood clots, and earlier this year, a knee replacement. We caught up with him at the farmer's market in Hudson, New York, where he's been a regular shopper for more than 20 years. The great thing about a farmer's market is that it takes care of the whole you, Roker explains. You get clean, organic food that's been brought to you by the people who grow it and produce it. And there's the social aspect of it, talking with the vendors, talking with the farmers. It's not like rush to the store, get to the express line, get out. You make a morning of it. For Roker, clean organic food is increasingly important. The best way to keep your health on track, he believes. It's to surround yourself with the best food possible. The best food is the freshest food, and your local farmer's market is what provides that. Roker says he and his wife, journalist Deborah Roberts, eat at home 4 or 5 nights a week, and dinner is usually something simple, either roasted in the oven or pan sautéed. Quote, I eat a lot of fish, a lot of chicken, and just olive oil, salt, pepper, and herbs. Just good quality proteins, lots of great veggies and herbs to elevate the flavor. And what about sauces? Sauce takes too much time, he laughs. I'm all about easy. Roker and Roberts usually take a quick walk after dinner, a healthy habit they try to stick to. After decades of interviewing diet experts, what's the tip he abides by the most? Moderation, says Roker. You can eat a lot of things. Just don't eat a lot of those things. He'll indulge in decadent foods, for example, but just a little taste. I don't need to eat the whole thing, so just less. Carla Hall, 59, chef and TV host. What's in her cart? Pre-cut veggies, tomatoes on the vine, full-fat dairy, and lots of eggs. During the COVID pandemic, Carla Hall thought she might want to become a bodybuilder. She started working out harder while following a strict regimen that included eating lots of broccoli, chicken, and rice. Then I realized that the women had to wear those crazy suits and high heels, and I was like, oh, no, laughs the former star of The Chew. Today, easy and sensible is Hall's shopping strategy. A frequent choice is a bag of pre-shredded vegetables. Quote, I never bother to cut them myself, she says, and not overcooking the veggies is key. Her secret salad tip? She buys cherry tomatoes on the vine, then soaks the vines in olive oil, giving the oil a grassy flavor. She makes her own dressing with mustard, hot sauce, honey, oil, and whatever vinegar is on hand. Put it in a jar and shake it, she says. One area where Hall doesn't scrimp, eggs. My grandfather was a doctor. There were a lot of bartering for his service. We would get eggs that were just harvested. Such a different taste. There's nothing like it. And that's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have questions about this or other programs on Chris Radio, call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long. Until next time.
This is Barbara Foster with Diabetes Update. Does the risk of stroke from common risk factors change as people age? Source is American Academy of Neurology. High blood pressure and diabetes are known risk factors for stroke, but now a new study shows that the amount of risk may decrease as people age. The study is published in an online issue of Neurology, the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology. High blood pressure and diabetes are two important risk factors for stroke that can be managed by medication, decreasing a person's risk, said study author George Howard, DPH of the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Public Health. Our findings show that their association with stroke risk may be substantially less at older ages, yet other risk factors do not change with age. These differences in risk factors imply that determining whether a person is at high risk for stroke may differ depending on their age. The study involved 28,235 people who had never had a stroke. Of this group, 41% were black and 59% were white. Participants were followed for an average of 11 years. At the start of the study, participants were interviewed and given physical exams to assess risk factors. Risk factors included high blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, atrial fibrillation, heart disease, and left ventricular hypertrophy, which is the thickening of the heart's left ventricle. Because of the well-known higher stroke risk in black people, race was also considered as part of the assessed risk factors, Howard added. Researchers followed up with participants every 6 months, confirming strokes by reviewing medical records. During the study, there were 1,405 strokes over 276,074 person years. Person years represent both the number of people in the study and the amount of time each person spends in the study. Participants were divided into three age groups, which were then compared. The age ranges for those groups varied slightly depending on the data being analyzed by researchers. In general, the younger group included participants ages 45 to 69. The middle group included people in their late 60s to 70s, and the older group included people 74 and older. Researchers found that people with diabetes in the younger age group were approximately twice as likely to have a stroke as people of similar age who did not have diabetes, while people with diabetes in the older age group had an approximately 30% higher risk of having a stroke than people of similar older age who did not have diabetes. Researchers also found that people with high blood pressure in the younger age group had an 80% higher risk of having stroke than people of similar age without high blood pressure, while that risk went down to 50% for people with high blood pressure in the older age group compared to people of similar age without high blood pressure. In addition, when researchers examined race as a risk factor, they found a higher stroke risk for black participants in the younger age group compared to white participants in that group. The race difference decreased in the older age group. For stroke risk factors such as smoking, atrial fibrillation, and left ventricular hypertrophy, researchers did not find an age-related change in risk. It is important to note that our results do not suggest that treatment of high blood pressure and diabetes becomes unimportant in older age, said Howard. Such treatments are still very important for a person's health, but it also may be wise for doctors to focus on managing risk factors such as atrial fibrillation, smoking, and left ventricular hypertrophy as people age. Howard also noted that even where the impact of risk factors decreases with age, the total number of people with strokes at older ages may still be larger since overall risk of stroke increases with age. For example, in the younger age group for high blood pressure, researchers estimated that about 2% of people with normal blood pressure had a stroke, compared to 3.6% of people with high blood pressure. In the older age group, about 6.2% of people with normal blood pressure had a stroke, compared to 9.3% of people with high blood pressure. A limitation of the research was that participants' risk factors were assessed only once at the start of the study, and it's possible they may have changed over time. The study was supported by the National Institutes of Health, including the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke and the National Institute on Aging. A common diabetes drug has a surprising side gig, muscle protector. Source, University of Utah Health. You might not think of diabetes when you think of muscle function, but a common diabetes drug that regulates blood sugar can also prevent muscle atrophy and muscular fibrosis, which can help the elderly bounce back faster from injury or illness. The University of Utah Health researchers have discovered that metformin, a common drug that's been used in diabetes treatment for more than half a century, has surprising applications on a cellular level. It can target zombie-like cells called senescent cells, which impact muscle function. Senescent cells secrete factors associated with inflammation that may underlie fibrotic tissue, a hardening or scarring of tissues. Metformin also reduces muscle atrophy. Their findings, published in Aging Cell. We're interested in clinical application of this research, says Micah Drummond, PhD, senior author of the study, and professor of physical therapy and athletic training at the College of Health. For example, knee surgeries in the elderly are notoriously hard to recover from. If we give a metformin-type agent during the recovery period, could we help the muscles get back to normal faster? Reinvigorating muscle recovery. As adults age, they're more likely to fall, be hospitalized, or develop chronic disease, and muscle disuse increases these risks. The research team wanted to find a therapeutic solution that could properly target both disuse atrophy and muscle recovery. There's an optimal level of senescent cells that are beneficial no matter your age. In younger, healthier people, short-term senescence is required for a proper recovery from injury, and completely blocking the senescent effect impedes the body's efforts to heal. Typically, a younger person can bounce back more easily after muscle disuse without the use of an intervention such as metformin. In the case of aging, we know that there's immune dysfunction, says Drummond. As you get older, it becomes harder for your body to clear senescent cells and they accumulate. That's one reason recovery is much slower for the elderly after periods of disuse. Metformin's anti-senescent properties have been demonstrated through preclinical studies. To test the intervention in humans, the team recruited 20 healthy male and female older adults for a multi-week study. They had participants undergo a muscle biopsy and MRI before the intervention, which involved 5 days of bed rest. One group of 10 received metformin, and the other 10 received placebo pills during a 2-week run-in period. Then each group continued the placebo or metformin treatment during bed rest. After the bed rest, participants received another muscle biopsy and MRI, then ceased treatments. All patients completed a 7-day reambulation period followed by a final muscle biopsy. We saw two things in our study, Drummond says. When participants took metformin during a bed rest, they had less muscle atrophy. During the recovery period, their muscles also had less fibrosis or excessive collagen. That buildup can make it harder for the muscle to properly function. Tying these results to senescence, the research team examined muscle biopsies from study participants. They found the participants who took metformin had fewer markers of cellular senescence. This is the first paper that has made the direct connection between a therapy targeting cellular senescence and improved muscle recovery following disuse in aging, says lead author Jonathan Petrocelli, Ph.D. He explains that metformin helps muscle cells better remodel and repair tissue during periods of recovery after inactivity. Our real goal is to have patients maintain their muscle mass and function as they age, because atrophy and weakness are some of the strongest predictors of disease development and death, he says. Drummond's team is followed up on is following up on these findings by combining the drug with leucine, an amino acid that promotes growth and could accelerate recovery even further. They've already demonstrated the potency of this combination in preclinical animal studies. Metformin is cheap, effective, and quite safe, so it's exciting to see that we can use it to accelerate recovery for older individuals, adds Drummond. Type 2 diabetes alters the behavior of discs in the vertebral column. Source, University of California, San Diego. Type 2 diabetes alters the behavior of discs in the vertebral column, making them stiffer and also causes the discs to change shape earlier than normal. As a result, the disc's ability to withstand pressure is compromised. This is one of the findings of a new study in rodents from a team of engineers and physicians from the University of California, San Diego, UC Davis, UCSF, and the University of Utah. Low back pain is a major cause of disability, often associated with intervertebral disc degeneration. People with type 2 diabetes face a higher risk of low back pain and disc-related issues. Yet the precise mechanisms of disc degeneration remain unclear. Investigating the biomechanical properties of the intervertebral disc is crucial for understanding the disease and developing effective strategies for managing low back pain. The research team was co-led by Claire Acevedo, a faculty member in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the University of California, San Diego, and Aaron Fields, faculty in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UC San Francisco. These findings provide novel insight into the potential mechanisms underlying diabetes-related disc tissue damage and may inform the development of preventative and therapeutic strategies for this debilitating condition, the researchers write. The study emphasizes that nanoscale deformation mechanisms of collagen fibrils accommodate compressive loading of the intervertebral disc. In the context of type 2 diabetes, these mechanisms are compromised, resulting in collagen embrittlement. These findings provide novel insight into the potential mechanisms underlying diabetes-related disc tissue damage and may inform the development of preventative and therapeutic strategies for this debilitating condition. Researchers employed synchrotron small angle X-ray scattering, SAXS, an experimental technique that looks at collagen fibril deformation and orientation at the nanoscale. They wanted to explore how alterations in collagen behavior contribute to changes in the disc's ability to withstand compression. They compared discs from healthy rats to those from rats with type 2 diabetes, UC Davis rat model. The healthy rats showed that collagen fibrils rotate and stretch when discs are compressed, allowing the disc to dissipate energy effectively. In diabetic rats, the way vertebral discs dissipate energy under compression is significantly impaired. Diabetes reduces the rotation and stretching of collagen fibrils, indicating a compromised ability to handle pressure, the researchers write. Further analysis showed that the discs from diabetic rats exhibited a stiffening of collagen fibrils with a higher concentration of non-enzymatic crosslinks. This increase in collagen cross-linking induced by hyperglycemia limited plastic deformations via fibrillar sliding. These findings highlight that fibril reorientation, straightening, stretching, and sliding are crucial mechanisms facilitating whole disc compression. Type 2 diabetes disrupts these efficient deformation mechanisms, leading to altered whole disc biomechanics and a more brittle, low-energy behavior. The team published their findings in the PNAS Nexus. Lockdown weight gain may have caused surge in new diabetes cases in kids. Source: Medical Express. Health Day. Rates and severity of type 2 diabetes among U.S. children rose during the COVID-19 pandemic, possibly due to weight gain during lockdowns, researchers say. While our study examined hospital admissions for type 2 diabetes in children at one center, the results may be a microcosm of what is happening at other children's hospitals across the country, said lead author Dr. Daniel Saya, an associate professor in the clinical trials unit at Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Stay-at-home orders increased risk factors for type 2 diabetes. They include less physical activity, more screen time, and other sedentary behaviors, sleep disturbances, and increased consumption of processed foods, all of which contribute to weight gain, according to the researchers. Even a slight weight gain over a short period can increase the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease. To learn more about type 2 diabetes in kids during the pandemic, the researchers compared the number and severity of hospitalizations for type 2 diabetes at Our Lady of the Lake Children's Hospital in Baton Rouge between March and December 2019, with the same period in 2020. The hospitalization rate for new-onset type 2 diabetes rose from 0.27%, 8 cases out of the 2,964 hospitalizations in 2019, compared to 0.62%, 17 out of 2,729, in 2020. Kids hospitalized in 2020 had more severe diabetes, with higher blood glucose, higher A1C, a marker of blood sugar over 3 months, and higher indicators of dehydration than those admitted in 2019, the study found. It also showed that in 2020, more kids had serious conditions that typically require admission to the intensive care unit, such as diabetic ketoacidosis, 8 children versus 3, and HHS, or hyperglycemic syndrome, 2 versus 0. Both conditions can lead to diabetic coma. Of 25 admissions in 2020, 23 were black children and 19 were boys, according to findings presented at a virtual meeting of the American Diabetes Association. Research presented at meetings is typically considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal. Unfortunately, COVID-19 disrupted our lives in more ways than we realize, Sia said in a meeting news release. Our study reinforces the importance of maintaining a healthy lifestyle for children, even under such difficult circumstances. Antacids may improve blood sugar control in people with diabetes. Source: The Endocrine Society. Antacids improved blood sugar control in people with diabetes, but had no effect on reducing the risk of diabetes in the general population, according to a new meta-analysis published in the Endocrine Society's Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Type 2 diabetes is a global public health concern affecting almost 10% of people worldwide. Doctors may prescribe diet and lifestyle changes, diabetes medications, or insulin to help people with diabetes better manage their blood sugar. But recent data points to common over-the-counter antacid medicines as another way to improve glucose levels. Our research demonstrated that prescribing antacids as an add-on to standard care was superior to standard therapy in decreasing hemoglobin A1C, HbA1c levels, and fasting blood sugar in people with diabetes, said study author Carol Chung-Hui Peng, MD of the University of Maryland Medical Center Midtown Campus in Baltimore, Maryland. For people without diabetes, taking antacids did not significantly alter their risk of developing the disease, said study author Wei K. Wang, MD of the Weilin Zhu Qi Hospital in Hualan, Taiwan. The researchers performed a meta-analysis on the effects of proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, a commonly used type of antacid medication, on blood sugar levels in people with diabetes and whether these medications could prevent the new onset of diabetes in the general population. The analysis included 7 studies, 342 participants for glycemic control, and 5 studies, 2,404,439 participants for risk of incident diabetes. The researchers found antacids can reduce HbA1c levels by 0.36% in people with diabetes and lower fasting blood sugar by 10 milligrams per deciliter, based on the results from 7 clinical trials. For those without diabetes, the results of the 5 studies showed that antacids had no effect on reducing the risk of developing diabetes. People with diabetes should be aware that these commonly used antacid medications may improve their blood sugar control, and providers could consider this glucose-lowering effect when prescribing these medications to their patients, said study author Kashif Munir, MD, associate professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Nutrition at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Boosting body heat production, a new approach for treating obesity. Source: Garvan Institute of Medical Research. A receptor that helps conserve energy when food is scarce may be the key to a safer approach to treating diet-induced obesity, research led by the Garvan Institute of Medical Research has revealed. In a study using experimental models and fat tissue biopsies from obese individuals, the team revealed that blocking a specific receptor of the molecule neuropeptide Y, NPY, which helps our body regulate its heat production, could increase fat metabolism and prevent weight gain. The Y1 receptor acts as a brake for heat generation in the body. In our study, we found that blocking this receptor in fat tissues transformed the energy-storing fat into energy-burning fat, which switched on heat production and reduced weight gain, says Dr. Yan Chuan Shi, leader of the neuroendocrinology group at Garvan and co-senior author of the paper published in Nature Communications. Most of the current medications used to treat obesity target the brain to suppress appetite and can have severe side effects that limit their use. Our study reveals an alternative approach that targets the fat tissues directly, which may potentially be a safer way to prevent and treat obesity. Y1 receptor linked to obesity. Obesity and overweight are major public health issues, which in Australia are estimated to affect 2/3 of all adults. The condition can lead to severe medical complications, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and some cancers. And while lifestyle changes are essential to weight loss, medication is a crucial adjunct treatment option for some. The authors of the study investigated Y1 receptor controlled by the molecule NPY, which is released in the body under conditions of starvation to help reduce energy expenditure and increase fat storage. Surprisingly, the team discovered that Y1 receptors were produced at higher levels in the fat tissue of obese individuals. The team then blocked the Y1 receptor using the experimental treatment B1B03304 in a mouse model of obesity. In our study, we found that mice were administered BIB03304 and fed a high-fat diet gained about 40% less body weight over 7 weeks than mice on a high-fat diet alone. This significant reduction of body weight gain was caused by an increase in body heat generation and reduction in fat mass, says Dr. Shi. Further, when we applied BIB03304 to human fat cells isolated from obese individuals, we found that the cells began switching on the same genes involved in producing heat as the ones in mice, which suggests that targeting the Y1 receptor pathway may similarly increase fat metabolism and reduce weight gain in humans, Dr. Shi adds. Targeting obesity at the source. NPY is a metabolism regulator that plays a critical role during states of low energy supply, where it helps store fat as a survival mechanism. Today, however, these advantageous effects can exacerbate existing diet-induced weight gain, leading to obesity and metabolic disease, says co-senior author Professor Herbert Herzog, head of the Eating Disorders Lab at Garvan. The researchers say a crucial component of the study was to demonstrate that the experimental treatment BIB-03304 did not cross the blood-brain barrier, and that the anti-obesity effects of blocking the Y1 receptor pathways occurred not via the brain, but specifically only in peripheral tissues. Most current prescribed treatments are aimed at reducing food intake by targeting the central nervous system. However, these can have significant psychiatric or cardiovascular side effects, which have resulted in over 80% of these medications being withdrawn from the market, says Dr. Shi. Our study is crucial evidence that blocking Y1 receptors in peripheral tissues without affecting the central nervous system is effective at preventing obesity by increasing energy expenditure. It reveals a new therapeutic approach that is potentially safer than current medications that target appetite, says Professor Herzog. Our team and other groups have revealed further potential benefits in targeting the NPY-Y1 receptor system, including the stimulation of bone cell growth and improvement in cardiovascular function and insulin resistance, he adds. We hope that the publication of our findings will lead to increased interest for exploring BIB-03304 and related agents as potential treatments for obesity and other health conditions.
This is Barbara Foster.